Well, I would think instantaneously self-recognition took over, and it was understood at once that the plaintiff had made some kind of an error. At that point, with hindsight, I think it also clear that a decision formed in the executive suite, and that is not to get entangled with the merits, and instead to prevail on the law. That is the law of procedure. What happened was that as the plaintiff understood the error and learned and confirmed, I might add, that the papers arrived at Time headquarters about 4 days, certainly no longer, after the last hour of the statute of limitations period, the plaintiff undertook to amend, to install Time Inc. as the defendant in the action. And at that stage, the defendant implemented its resolve to concentrate on the procedure and moved for a summary judgment. The defendant prevailed twice, once in the district court, again in the Court of Appeals. At issue is Rule 15C, the second sentence. I mention the second sentence because it focuses so squarely on party amendments of pleadings that it must be taken to be the rule that governs, and it was certainly the one upon which the courts below concentrated. That rule, adopted in 1966, has these characteristics. It begins by saying that it governs an amendment changing the party, and I underscore both changing and the, and then goes on to lay down the requirements first, that the person to be brought in, the defendant to be brought in, must have had notice of the pending action. Secondly, that the overall circumstances are such that no prejudice would be entailed by allowing the amendment. And thirdly, that it must be clear to the person eventually brought in that but for some hapless error, he would have been the one originally named. Now, unquestionably, Time Inc. fitted these requirements pretty much as a hand might fit a glove, but the overriding requirement also in the rule is the following, that this awareness must come home to the party to be brought in, quote, within the period provided by law for commencing the action against him. Now, almost from the inscription, this provision in the federal civil rules, two schools emerged. One, and I think it historically to be the first in the Fifth Circuit, was to say that this ought to be given a reading infused with its purpose, i.e. with its history. And if so, what would happen is that the period for awareness or notice to the party to be brought in would be no shorter than that which would normally come to that very same party if originally and correctly identified. Now, in the latter case, a complaint can be filed the last hour of the limitations period and then promptly and within a reasonably short time, but not instantaneously, the summons and complaint go out and can be served.
Mr. Schnetzler?
Yes, sir.
Was your complaint filed in the district court within the statute of limitations period?
Yes, sir, and there's absolutely no dispute about that. None whatever. That was one rule. A single standard of notice serves the purpose of the 15C. Yes, Your Honor.
Notice was not served. Wasn't it refused?
The first notice came with the summons and complaint.
Wasn't it refused? R-E-F-U-S-E-D?
Yes, Your Honor.
It was refused.
Yes, but, Your Honor,
is that notice?
At headquarters. In other words, somebody read this and then as he said about the Englishman who received a tax form from Inland Revenue, he declined to subscribe.
But you knew it had been refused, didn't you?
Pardon?
You knew it had been refused.
Oh, certainly.
And what did you then do and when?
Move to
amend. What did you then do and when?
I'm not sure I have the exact date, but my recollection is that it was refused on May 23, Your Honor, and I think the motion to amend came in June. But by that time, not only was Time Inc. aware of the action.
How was it aware of it?
Your Honor, by reading the summons and complaint.
They didn't read it. They refused it.
Are you saying that the record...
No, I'm only saying they refused it.
They did, Your Honor, but my understanding
is... Well, how can you say they read it if they said, if the record shows that they refused it? The whole purpose on accepting it is to show that you read it. If you refuse to accept, you say you refuse to read it.
I have the different impression. I have the impression that they read it and said, this is a vaccination that doesn't take with us. Oh, you're certainly right, Your Honor, in saying that they wouldn't accept
and
it.
And you admit you were wrong.
Oh, I gladly do that.
So what are you going to put the weight on them for?
Wait. We have a rule applying to all. And the question is, how should it be read? And if read, as three circuits have read it, Time can refuse or accept summonses and complaints just as they choose, but it will be a vaccination that takes. It will be a summons and complaint which is neglected at the peril of the party who's doing that. And for that, the default procedure is well installed in the rules.
Suggesting, Mr. Schnitzer, that they had to read it before they knew whether they would refuse it or accept it.
I am, how shall I say, morally certain that it was read and that a study decision was made after conferences with counsel who decided that a mistake about the name was something that could be capitalized.
If they didn't read it, they might find themselves having default judgments entered against them in appropriate cases. Is that not so?
Not only would that happen, but it seems to me that anybody who accosted by a sheriff who says, I have a summons and complaint for him, says, goodbye, I have another appointment, takes the consequences. That is, he's chargeable with notice of what he could have read. I think that in procedure is fairly basic.
But, Mr. Schnitzer, by the time that Time Inc. received notice under your theory,
yes.
That was after the statute of limitations.
The whole crux of the case is exactly that. For the two lower courts, it was as follows, that there is a double standard, i.e., one for a party to be brought in who must learn before the statute of limitations expires Cinderella fashion midnight of the last evening of the period. And if he doesn't, he can spend the rest of his life free from the entanglement of the case. Whereas, had this very defendant been correctly named and received notice at the instant in time when it got it through the summons and complaint, there couldn't have been the slightest doubt that they would have heaved a sigh and proceeded to address the merits in which we hope to engage some
guests. Yes, do you have for not naming the proper party?
Your Honor, I haven't heard.
What possible excuse do you offer for not naming the original party?
An error, Your Honor. I repeat the admission of error. It was simply an error, and it was an avoidable error. If that matters, that too is in the record.
Well, isn't that the reason you have rules?
Pardon?
You have rules so that people do not make mistakes.
Your Honor, let me say it's just the reverse, and let me tell you why.
Well, you don't want the rule, do you?
Pardon?
You can come in and say any rule of this court or any other court. I made a mistake, so I'm excused. That's what you want the rule to be.
That has not been my experience, because I've made my quota of mistakes, and what I've found is that this magnificent body of sparse and sparely worded rules has within it the capability to fulfill what I regard as the first commandment of all procedure inscribed in Rule 1, and that is to use the litigation period as an interval of gestation for the safe delivery of the merits into a final judgment at the other end of the process, unmarred and unblemished by procedure, so that if mistakes are made, and this rule was written to correct mistakes, if mistakes are made by a wise discipline, the system absorbs it because it's in the nature of the human condition to be frail and occasionally lapsing into mistakes. So the whole system of procedure, I think, has in my mind, a beautiful balance in tension between regularity and system, without which the process might be most seriously marred, and benign correction within limits. Now, as I say,
May I ask you a question? Do you agree? I notice your amendment says fortune also known as time incorporated. Do you say they are different parties or the same party?
Your Honor, there is only one.
Well, if there are only one, is your amendment an amendment changing the party against whom the claim is asserted within the meaning of the rule?
Of course not.
So you don't think the rule applies at all?
Your Honor, here's the argument. In words, it does not. There are three kinds of party changes. Misnomer, the wrong name for the right party. Switching, B for A, and B and A are two different distinct parties. C, editor, addition, a brand new party without dropping anybody so that the number enlarges. This rule was written for only Class B, switching, changing a party, not adding a party, not correcting the name of a party. But,
in the process of composing it, the commission, this Court's Rules Commission, in proceeding to write the rule narrowly, proceeded to comment on it broadly. So by an overreach of comment, they said, we are gathering in misnomer. Why they didn't say so is a problem. And we're also gathering in party addition. And once again, why they didn't say so is a comment. But the courts have generally taken this attitude. We will work within the overbroad comment about a more narrowly worded rule. But also, in my view, the Commission was quite unmistakable in its, how shall I put it, in its expressed intention to make sure that this very scenario would never happen again.
Well, are you saying that the same rule applies to a case in which you serve time inc when you mean to serve time incorporated, as if you had served time when you meant to serve Newsweek, say? Is it the same rule? And you would then later change it to correct it?
Yes, if you will be consistent and say that if the rule is given an overbroad interpretation, let it also be infused with the Commission's purpose, which by definition reads
the magic words, within the period provided by law for commencing the action against him, to include a period for timely service after the expiration of the period.
And what is timely service? The period when it would have been timely for a summons and complaint to reach a correctly named party in the first instance. Now, my answer to you, Justice Stevens, then is, sure, it applies to all three categories despite the fact that it doesn't say so, if you will also take the same source, the commission source, for the intended interpretation of this limiting sentence. And two reasons. One, four cases had been decided within a very short period of time in which...
Mr. Snitker, it would help if you would stay in front of the microphones. It's a little hard for us to hear on this side. Within a period of a year, four cases had been decided in district courts dismissing appeals from Social Security decisions. And in one of them, we do have the scenario in detail. The others are probably fit the same thing. Filed within 60 days. Named a government officer, but not the right one. All dismissed when amendments were sought and failed. In one of them, the Sandridge case, the scenario is exactly this case. A last hour filing of the complaint. A summons and complaint went out to a government officer, not the right one, of course. And then a motion to amend. Court dismissed in all four. Professor Bies wrote an article in which he barely suppressed the acerbity of his criticism. As professors sometimes do with court decisions, and insisted on a rule change, giving up on the hope that the courts would arrive at that result by rule interpretations. This rule emerged with the express object of overcoming Sandridge, the facts of this very case. So I'm on pretty good ground, I think, when I say that if the rule should be fulfilled in its outreach, i.e. as applied to Ms. Stomer, then let it be fulfilled in every nook and cranny of the comment, and that would be to overcome
Sandridge. Were all of those cases you mentioned explainable mistakes? For example, when you named the wrong officer, I still am unable to understand that you have an explainable defense. You just made a mistake. You could have called up the New York Times Information Service and found out who owned it.
I accept everything Your Honor says because it's very definitely true. The mistake could have been prevented and, of course, should have been prevented. But the question is, given the mistake, how does the system deal with it?
And we wouldn't have to worry with it.
That's so, Your Honor. As I've said, there are two sets of approaches. One, the Second Circuit. It came early, but it climaxed in an opinion by then-Chief Judge Feinberg in Ingram v. Kumar, and no exposition on my part will improve on what I regard as the pinnacle of insight about the correct application of the rule. The Second Circuit simply held that a double standard of notice designed to contain prejudice and to become a rule of thumb for assessing prejudice, that a double standard of notice is not only anomalous, but is inherently incompatible with the fair administration of a rule of this court for which the intention need not be sought in other publications, but for which the court is only to look inward, as this court carries the responsibility for the consequences of how its rules work in practice, i.e. by the Polestar standard of whether the merits can be addressed and fulfilled, or whether they're blocked out by some error which the court has the means to correct. In my view, there are five strong reasons why the court below should be reversed. First, that as applied in the Third Circuit as compared with the Second, it achieves a double standard of notice for which there is no logic, no reason, no policy. As a matter of fact, Judge Seitz in this very case said, in point of policy, our view, the view for which I contend this morning, is, quote, appealing. And he arrived at the other result because he felt himself, or rather the court, to be within a straitjacket of inept terminology in Rule 15C. Now, it is some commentary on a rule of law that a judge squirms visibly in the process of applying it, and that's quite true about every application of the point of view which the Third Circuit adopted in this case, because as courts comment on it, the most that they can say is that the rule is too plain not to read literally, but no policy, no other reason or justification for that result, whereas those who favor the point of view that for which I argue, among courts, have this to say, that they find it appealing. A member of this court said that. As a policy matter, it's quite persuasive. That was Judge Seitz. That the other point of view is anomalous, Judge Feinberg. That the construction for which I contend is permissible and desirable, again, Judge Feinberg. The Sixth Circuit, they were stronger. They said about the other rule that it was narrow, formalistic, and Professor Bies capped it all by saying it was niggly. In any case, a outcome ought not to be rested on adjectives or adverbs, but it says something when, in point of policy, every court which comments on it says the right road is this direction, and somehow I'm compelled to take the other one. Well, I submit that that is not a penultimate compulsion, for as this court wrote the rule, it can read the rule, and to read the rule to match its purpose, and its purpose at least was unmistakable in 1966. There's another reason. Justice Stevens, by his question, noted that this case belongs with misnomers. Now, there is no state system of procedure I know that is today so primitive that it would labor, much less gag, over the correction of misnomer. Now, I think there's something more than anomalous if in 1986, in this court, a standard application of correction of misnomer, as distinguished from other party changes, is, when measured by procedural developments throughout the country, regressive. And yet that's what it would be, at least by comparison. I have already said that in my outlook, any rule in this thin book which applies in such a way as to blemish, deform, much less screen out the merits over procedural errors which are correctable without prejudice.
One of the purposes of the rules is to require things to be done in a particular period of time. You have to have some time limits.
Of course. And I advocate it, Your Honor. And I advocate it exactly as defined by the committee's comment in my reading and by Judge Feinberg in his reading of that and two other circuits as well, i.e., the very same period of time and not a day longer then would be appropriate to bring notice home to this very same party had this very same party been correctly named in the first place. No double standard, no endless stretch out. All things must end, including litigation and stages in litigation. But no double standard.
The reason the Third Circuit said the double standard was because your case is different than that of the kind you say that it should be analogized to.
Oh, on the contrary, Your Honor, the Third Circuit merely shrugged and sighed and said the rule is too literally written to allow us to infuse it with some higher purpose. And I say that no rule in this book is written in that fashion.
Well, the higher purpose is to let in people who make mistakes?
Oh, not... Well, of course, Your Honor, because it's a part of a system of procedure to involve and to cope with frailties, not only of the litigants, which give rise to the meritorious claims, but even lawyers who sometimes fall below the standard of perfection, as I'm sure I do and have, and I remember some of those episodes. Now, the rules have flexibility. They were written to have a little give so that the elbows are not constrained or tied to the frame. They were meant not to be loose, heaven forbid, but they were meant to move slightly, particularly in the three classic instances which is so familiar to any practitioner, and that is you do have misnomer, there is the oversight of forgetting to tag one additional party, and then there are the occasions when you aim the arrow at A only to learn later on B. Now, no system except the narrow interpretation of 15C bars that. Has ever barred that, by the way, past what our former Chief Justice Vanderbilt used to call the special pleading, which Byron Park made so well known. So our system, the federal civil practice system, is quite capable of dealing with mistakes. 15C was designed exactly to do that. And the question is, will it work? Your Honor, if any time is left, I reserve it for rebuttal.
Mr. Bouncer.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The petitioners would have this Court, in the guise of doing justice in their particular cases, engage in a radical enterprise, namely, amending a federal rule in the guise of construing it and establishing a principle, which I think is novel in the federal rules, that the clear language of the rules may be disregarded and new language implied into the rule when the Court might prefer the result so obtained in a particular case.
Mr. Justice, many courts who disagree with your view are radical?
I think the Second Circuit has disagreed with it and other circuits who have implied the period of reasonable service as an additional time. I think that is what they have done.
What if, as often happens in criminal cases, the complaint here had described fortune A period, K period, A period, also known as Time Incorporated. Would that have satisfied the rule?
Well, I think we would have had to ask Judge Sarakin that, and he probably would have contested it. When the complaint was amended, that was the way it was stated, because the plaintiffs then and petitioners now were trying to gloss over the fact that they had initially named a party which lacked capacity and were trying really to say they had just misnamed a proper party and were trying to bring it within a misnomer rather than a change of party rule.
Does this record show whether the person to whom the complaint was presented made a Xerox or other copy of it before they refused the service?
Yeah. Let me clarify that. The service was made by a mailing. I think it was made by certified mail to one of the corporation trust companies, which was the registered agent, so addressed for Time Incorporated. It was sent under the relatively new procedure under Rule 4 with a form of acknowledgement of service so that it might be acknowledged by the person being served, and that constitute the consummation of service in lieu of the old procedure of sending a marshal out. So that what happened is when this was received, as Mr. Schnitzer indicates, it was transmitted to Time, which made the judgment, which was later expressed to Mr. Schnitzer's co-counsel, that the entity named was not Time, it was not an entity capable of being sued, therefore Time Incorporated took the position that it was not a proper party, it was not named in the suit, and therefore it refused to sign that acknowledgement of service. And this was duly and promptly communicated to Mr. Geiser, Mr. Schnitzer's colleague, so that there was no doubt that Time had access to and read a copy of the complaint after it was received, within a few days after it was received and transmitted to them. The refusal, which I think Mr. Schnitzer was relating to, was the refusal to acknowledge proper service in satisfaction of Rule 4, and I think that's just to clarify.
Well, your position is, I take it, or Time's position was that there wasn't any party at all named in the complaint.
That is correct, and we raised that issue.
The amendment, for the first time, named a party.
That is correct. And Judge Sarikin so found, because in his order, he referring to the history that's fortune as a service mark and as a publication, says, as such, defendants contend that the fortune lacks capacity to be sued. Now,
had Time been named as a party, the service would have been good, and the statute of limitations would not have barred the suit.
If Time in its proper name had been named, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But Time was not named. In fact, I just want to finish. It said plaintiffs do not urge that Fortune has the capacity to be sued. At the district court level, the plaintiffs acknowledged, and Judge Sarikin found, that they had named an entity not capable of being sued. They had named, in effect, a product. It was like suing Crest toothpaste instead of Colgate-Palmolive, or suing Chevrolet instead of...
Would you agree, Mr. Banner, that the service would have been proper if the complaint had not mentioned Time at all, but it just said publisher of Fortune? Instead of Fortune.
I don't think so. I think that's a misdescription. And under Rule 15C and the advisory committee notes, misdescriptions are included within the definition of a change of party.
So that would not be a valid service. Supposing they said Time Inc. instead of Time Incorporated.
I was asked the same questions at the Third Circuit. There's a point that's so close that where I think it's clear that they have named
and how do you how do you differentiate between those that are so close and the is it a question of whether you understand who's being sued?
I think if it's purely typographical, I think an abbreviation is de minimis. I think that I don't know of any cases dealing with it.
But what if it said the corporation which publishes the magazine Fortune, whose name I don't at the moment know?
Well, that's really a John Doe complaint. And the federal system has not really sanctioned John Doe complaints.
How did the person to whom the complaint was first mailed know enough to give it to Time?
This is in the record. In the transmittal letter that accompanied the complaint, which was sent by Mr. Schnitzer's associates, they said, "This is sent to you." I'm paraphrasing now. In your capacity as registered agent for Time Incorporated, who are the publishers of Fortune, they're the name to defend it. So that is why the registered agent knew who to do it. The letter told
letter,
him who it was.
That letter was, I suppose, transmitted to Time also with the complaint.
That is correct. Yes. And that letter was written.
So Time at that point knew that the intention was to sue Time Incorporated.
I think that's a fair inference.
Yeah. So no one was misled.
That is correct.
We did not know it within the period of the statute limitations.
That is absolutely correct. The statute was ruled to have expired no later than May 19, 1983. That was as close as Judge Sarikin had to call it. The mailing of the notice to the registered agent took place on the 20th. It was received on the 23rd. So there is no question that the initiation of process did not occur until after the expiration of the statute, and that's not inconsistent.
In your view, as distinguished from being a mistake or a correct application of the rule, would it be irrational for a court to conclude that the cover letter was part of the pleadings?
I think it would be irrational. I think partly because it was never filed with the court. I think that there have been cases, and I don't want to press it.
Is it in the record? Is the letter in the record?
I believe so, without being able to assure the court. My recollection is that the letter is in the record. But I think one of the things that emerges is that you will very seldom, I think, ever see a case where there are fewer equities on the side of the plaintiffs. At the same time as this case was initiated, and this is in the record, another case involving many of the same plaintiffs, same defendants' counsel, plaintiffs' counsel, involving Mr. Chavone and Time Incorporated, was pending in the United States District Court and the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. The same players in a slightly different game on a slightly different ball field. So that there's no question, and that complaint properly named the defendant, Time Incorporated. It happened to be publishing Time magazine instead of Fortune magazine, but there's no question that they knew. There's no question that they blew it. But that so that
let me just be sure I have one thing understood.
Yes.
You do agree, though, this rule applies to misnomers as well as the true changes of parties.
Yes, it does. The advisory committee made that very clear in their statement. And I think what they were trying to do is to keep the district courts from having to go through a very difficult analysis in each case as to whether a particular amendment really involved a misnomer or misdescription on the one hand or a change of party on the other with a different outcome of rule. I think there's the record or the inference from what the advisory committee did is to say, we're going to lump these all together and the same rule applies to them all and avoid that determination having
to be made. But is it not true that under the prior law of misnomer, there were lots of cases with very, very trivial differences, such as the difference between Time Incorporated and Time Inc., which were treated as misnomers, and the misnomer rule applied to those cases?
Well, I think some of the misnomer cases, there was always a problem, and that is there was a second corporation with the name of the misnamed corporation.
But it would seem to me, and I don't really understand what your answer to this is, if they had sued Time Inc. instead of Time Incorporated, I don't know why you couldn't make precisely the same argument. And you should prevail, it seems to me, if you're right in this case.
Because it's just a clear
misnomer. They got the wrong name.
There might be other questions. If Time had used Time, Inc. in various
publications. No, just you have it on your masthead. The reason it comes to mind is that Mr. Schnitzer, and I'm sure in good faith, kept referring to you as Time, Inc. in his argument. And you're not Time, Inc. He was talking about somebody that's not even here.
I think one of the problems with Time, Inc. is I think Time, Inc. has used its name in both forms and fashions, and would be at least an estoppel involved in a misnomer. And I think a misnomer.
But surely the question of service can't depend on whether the corporation has made that mistake itself.
Well, I think that the courts have looked to defendants' conduct as misleading plaintiffs, and where that has been a material issue, they have felt that they have the power to do that.
Well, putting misleading conduct to one side, putting that entirely one side, assume you have been very regular in the use of the name and always use Time Incorporated, then your argument would be available to someone who made the mistake of suing you as Time Inc.
I think the Third Circuit said it didn't have to pass on the issue.
Logically, if we can't look at equities or anything, we just follow the plain language. It covers that case just as
Literally applied, it does. An ampersand instead of an and, perhaps something even pronounced the same. Our position is that the effect of Rule 15C, the way it is construed by us and the way it's been adopted, is to do two things. It is to say to plaintiffs, in effect, there are two ways you can perfect your claim against the defendant. The first is properly to name the defendant in its proper corporate name or individual name, spelled right, whatever, and to file this complaint with the court within the period of the statute of limitations. Or there's an alternate way of perfecting a claim, and this is the way that 15C provides, and that is to file this complaint, possibly misnaming the proper party so-called to be served, misspelling it, to file this complaint, but within the period of before the expiration of the statute of limitations to give actual notice of the lawsuit, in effect, to the proper party to be served. And then your amendment to correct will relate back. And 15C really provides an additional alternate way for plaintiffs to perfect their relief, their complaint. It does not go quite as far as Mr. Schnitzer says, and that's why we're here today. But it is not the double standard in the language he says. It is an alternate way for plaintiffs who have misnamed defendants, who have named the wrong party, and many of these cases involve naming a wrong party, a subsidiary instead of a parent, a brother-sister corporation situation. It is a way for plaintiffs to cure that. The advisory committee was very clear that they felt that this notice should be given within the period of the statute of limitations. And they said in their advisory note, they mean the limitations period. So that I think the arguments that Mr. Schnitzer raises are good legislative arguments to be addressed to a rulemaking body, to the advisory committee, to the judicial conference, and they certainly have some appeal there and might be grounds for consideration of any amendment. But to imply this reasonable period of service test into the clear language and in the face of the advisory committee report appears to cause a very serious problem of that the rule does not longer mean what it says. And then you still have the same problem of whether service was timely made within whatever reasonable period of service is made. And you're going to have determinations before district judges as to whether service was timely. Even in the Ingram Kumar case, which was referred to, the service was not within 120 days at that time. And so that you'll still have district judges passing on the adequacy of service down the road. So I think that the plaintiffs now, under Rule 4, allowing for the initiation of process by mailing, have it within their power to get a summons out promptly. They are not at the mercy of the marshal not serving. They now have control over the timing of service so that they are not at the mercy of the marshal's negligence depriving them of the benefit of 15C by failing to serve within time. So that benefit and that opportunity was given. I'm not contending that our refusal to acknowledge would defeat 15C if that were the case. There's no, I think that's not, that service for probably 15C purposes would be good if it were timely because it furnishes actual notice. Whether it's an acknowledgement for Rule 4 purposes, it does, is one matter, but it's certainly actual notice for purposes of 15C. The policies of the statute of limitations have not really been touched on. They are definitely in the back of the consideration, and statutes of limitations frustrate decisions on the merits, but they serve another policy. And any plaintiffs who tiptoe right up to the edge of the statute of limitations before they take their actions run the risks of running afoul of statutes of limitations, and unfortunately it happens all the time, and I'm afraid will probably continue to happen. Results may sometimes be different from what state law provides, but we're in a federal system. We have federal rules, federal causes of action, and so that I think there's no, and this court has already ruled that in procedural rules in Hanna versus Plummer, there is no necessity that the outcomes be the same as in the state courts. Even back in the history, the impetus, I think it's clear, came from Professor Bice's article referring to the four suits. Those were suits against the government. That's a very thorny, difficult area. It's not one our case is specifically concerned with. I know this court has. The Cooper case came up seeking certification within the year. Other cases may come along. Short statutes of limitation. Some confusion probably among practitioners as to who the proper party is to be sued. It's a difficult area. Rule 15C has special rules to deal with that, which help to ease that particular question. They provide that the service within this limitations period can be accomplished by mailing. All you have to do is mail within the limitations period, and the government is bound, which is somewhat broader. And it also provides that you serve the Attorney General or the U.S. Attorney, even if the substantive cause of action requires both, if service on one would be sufficient. It also provides that service on a proper agent for service counts if he would have been an agent for the defendant properly named. If you name the United States Postal Service and serve the U.S. Attorney, he cannot come in and say, well, that's improper service. The proper party was the United States of America. And while I could be served on behalf of the United States of America, I was served in a different capacity for the Postal Service, and that is invalid. That issue, in fact, was raised in the Edwards case cited in our brief and was rejected. So there is certainly definitely much relief for litigants in the context of federal causes of action. I think one of the problems there.
It is still true, is it not, that apart from the service problem, if you had the same kind of fact scenario that you have here and you named the United States when you should have named the United States Postal Service and didn't correct it till after the statute ran, you'd be out of luck.
Absolutely. Yeah. There was no question that...
So the same rule applies to the government as to private parties.
Timeliness of the notice to the government is absolutely crucial, and that is in our briefs, goes right back to the beginning of Rule 15C and the amendments, and Professor Bice even comments in his article on that, but the government received notice within the limitation period. So he was concerned about the technicalities of naming the wrong party, but if you serve the right party, he was willing to feel that there should be a rule overlooking the technicalities of naming the secretary who just left office rather than the incumbent or something along those lines. So that our position is that Rule 15C is workable. It's very important that it be applied as it reads. The implication that's asked for by Mr. Schnitzer, namely the additional period of service, the Ingram rule, is really grafting a whole additional concept onto the rule, which, if appropriate to be done, and I'm not saying it is, would have to be done in a legislative context. The rulemaking procedure, the Rules Enabling Act, that process, comments. This rule was submitted to the bar for 20 years ago for a whole year for comment prior to its adoption. The issue that we're now in litigation on was raised in the Martz case while the rule amendment was pending, yet no changes were made in the rule at the time. So the issue is one that we can hardly say came up and caught everyone by surprise. So for these reasons, we feel that the court should affirm the judgments below and find in favor of our clients, Time Incorporated.
Your Honor, may I respond briefly?
First, page 33A of the Joint Appendix is the letter of transmittal to Corporation Trust Company, the registered agent, and states on May 20th, only hours after the statute of limitations had run out, not even a full day, you will find enclosed herewith the summonses and complaints in the above matter directed to Fortune. As you know, Fortune is a publication of Time Incorporated, and it is for that reason that we are serving you, the New Jersey registered agent for Time Incorporated. So if Time Incorporated knew what its registered agent knew, and at the same time, not a full day had elapsed after the statute had run out, and knew that it was intended. Secondly, Professor Kaplan, who was then chairman of the advisory commission, wrote an article in 81 Harvard Law Review referring to the case which gave a narrow interpretation to the time for notice to the party to be brought in and said, politely, it was wrongly decided. Thirdly, one of the four cases to which Professor Bice addressed himself in the seminal article that gave rise to Rule 15C is exactly this scenario. The facts are spelled out in the opinion. It says the complaint was filed the last day, and it follows that the first notice to the government came afterwards. That was the result to be reversed by 15C.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...